sake of using the time well, I think I'm going to go ahead, and if you're not distracted, we'll just let people get settled as they wish, and it doesn't distract me. So we'll just do what we need to do, and I'll carry on. Can I have a sense of how many of you were not here last night, so I can get a... Oh my, all right. So I'm going to give you a very quick overview of what I said last night, and I also would like to answer a few questions that have come to me through the day, which makes me understand that some of the things that I said last night needed a little clarification. So I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to pause for a minute and let any of you who wish to question me at that time to do so, because it is important that we get the basic issues clean and clear. And then after that, then I'd like to talk on the whole subject of finding a life work. The main thing that I was talking about last night was that we need to see our life in its various seasons or stages. That the old way of thinking was that adults, once they hit something like 21 or so, were pretty much set. That you had done as much growing as you were likely to do, and that you were then measured and valued according to how steady you could stay. If you had been raised right, you would then be a healthy human being who would have their life decisions made, and they would basically carry on until it came time for retirement. We know that isn't right. We know that as adults, we keep going through growth stages, even as children do, and even as adolescents do, that we keep changing and growing in the same way. And that there is a kind of predictability about this kind of thing, that we do grow in a kind of rhythm, that about every 7 to 10 years, and there are people like Toffler and other people who insist that it's speeding up because of the high rate of change in our society, and because I think people are changing more rapidly also because of our own higher degree of education and our own higher awareness of our choices. So Toffler would say that maybe every 5 years you need to say, and now what? But at any rate, I see in my own clients in Seattle that about every 7 to 10 years, people have to stop and say, who am I now? And what are my life options at this point? Because the world has changed, and I have changed, and the people around me have changed. And so I must stop and say, and now what, Lord? And to do this is simply a basic kind of self-respect, which says, what happens to my life and what I do with my life is of utmost value. And I want to make the best job of this business of living that I possibly can. It's not out of a kind of vanity. It is out of a kind of self-respect, one which I think many of us were not taught to do too well. We were often taught to do for others, but not to respect ourselves enough to do this kind of self-study and self-planning. And I know that one of the things that fascinated me was that when I started to work with businessmen, I discovered that they spend an enormous amount of energy planning for the future, and yet for the company. And yet they themselves spent no time planning their own lives. And I thought, oh, isn't this scandalous? But then I looked around at us all, and that was about the same for everybody. It wasn't just businessmen who didn't pay attention to their own life planning. So I was talking about the fact that about every 7 to 10 years, or if some life event comes from the outside, like a death, or a divorce, or a loss of your money, the loss of a job, the loss of health, a real health crisis, or if simply you get to the point of what I call a loss of innocence, in which suddenly you see the world as a rather hostile place. It's a process of growing up in which you suddenly see things, perhaps as they've always been, but which suddenly makes an impact on your own life. I know that happened to me living in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. Suddenly, the reality, if you will call it that, of the world, landed on me with great force, and I could no longer only think good thoughts and believe that everything would work out without any assistance from me. I suddenly realized I had to become involved, and whatever you want to call that point in time, in which you start to take responsibility for yourself and say, and who am I, and what can I do next to do a good job of using the gifts that God has given me. How can I best do that? Then I think you start to see that whether it's an external event or the simple coming about through adult development stages, you know that you are in charge of your future. Now, this is not to imply that you are not within the care of God. Of course you are. I feel this more powerfully every day. But at the same time, I take responsibility for knowing myself well enough to know how I can best use this creature that God has created. And to know yourself well enough really requires a lot of work. I thought, you know, when I was told, live the examined life, Socrates, or know thyself and to thine own self be true. I thought that maybe this happened through some kind of mystic process, that one day I would wake up and know. And it never happened. I found I had to know myself through really disciplined work, to know who I was, what my strengths were, what my capacities were, what my options were, what kind of work there was out there needing to be done, what kind of things I was naturally talented to do, which kinds of skills I would have to make myself learn. All those kind of things were part of this process of knowing who I am and what my potential is. But I showed yesterday a kind of schematic, and I'm going to not try to take time to pass it out now, but those of you who would like to come up and get some afterwards may do so. I was sketching out what I called a three-part self, which I designed in an attempt to understand this question of who am I? Well, at the very least, there are three selves. And I don't mean to imply that this is a separation of selves. In fact, of course, it is all a blended self. But for the purposes of thinking, you can say, I am an individual. And the best way for me to think of this is to say, I come into this world alone and I leave alone. And I am responsible for what I do with myself between the coming in and the going out. That I am responsible not only to myself but to the Creator as to what I do with myself there in this basic, essential aloneness. And the best way I can think of it is as self as being, that this is the one self, one aspect of the self that I really need to know. And then last night we were talking quite a bit about the self in relationship. And the reality there is between you and somebody else. This is a beautiful self. It is also a fragile self because the reality is between. And so somebody else has to be both willing and able to be there for you. And as we go through the life stages, there is no question but that we have to learn new skills and new ways of relating because we keep changing and the people around us keep changing, so that sometimes the people we love are neither able or sometimes not willing to be there for us. And so we have to understand how beautiful, fragile, and how vulnerable we are in this area of the self. Then over here I use the phrase life work self, and this life work self is really the self in action. It's the self manifesting itself in what you do. Now it's not busy work. It is not having to be active in the usual meaning of the word. Certainly prayer is a work. In my book, prayer is a supreme work. So I am not talking about the self in action in the Mickey Mouse sense of, you know, busy, busy, do, do, do. Although I'm not against that either. I think that's a marvelous way of being active and involved in the community and in work in various capacities. But if we're looking at the three selves, this is self as being, self with others, if you wish, and this is the self in action. And as you study the three selves, you get a sense. You notice I use dotted lines. This is to show that the energies flow around, that as you grow and develop as an individual, that impacts how you relate to other people. I'm sort of fascinated by many of the articles on relationships, they talk as though the relationship can be any better than the people in the relationship. To use a very homey illustration, it's sort of like trying to make a good cake out of Wheatley flour and rancid margarine. The cake is no better than the ingredients, even if you stir it beautifully. So that relationships are a direct outgrowth of the kind of person you are. That as you are developing the self as being, that impacts your relationships. And the energy that comes from good relationships, of course, blesses how you function as a worker. The energies that you develop as a worker, of course, flow into relationships that goes around in all directions. And what is fascinating is that if you are paying attention to these various selves and trying to invest approximately a third of your life energies, if you will, into each of these segments, you find yourself literally creating new energy. In fact, when you are doing a life work, you can always tell when you're in a life work because you are less tired when you're through than when you started. In other words, you have a taste of a life work when you are tired, but you go and do it anyway, and you realize at the end of it that you are less tired than when you started. How many of you have experienced that? You've gone and you've been tired, but then all of a sudden you feel the energy coming. You see, I'll be less tired at the end of this hour than I will be at the beginning. I was tired coming up this day. My friend Willa has made me climb mountains. I think that what I would like to do here is just stop for a minute and just give one other little piece of information that somebody asked me about today. They said, do you really think that at any one point in your life you can be, quote, balanced? I said, no, the phrase at the top is balancing with an I-N-G. You're always in process of balancing. And there are times and seasons in your life when in no way can you be in even approximate balance. I was using my own life as an illustration that there was one time when I had four children under the age of six. And I look back on it, and given who I am, given my temperament, I know that at that period in my life, I was a little crazy. Because I really didn't know what to do with this situation, but because I was raised to carry on, I carried on. But I think those children really had a slightly nutty mother. But that was not forever. It was a period in my life when I was willing to invest and to risk myself in the raising of the children because they were a precious part of my life, and I saw it in perspective. I was telling the people last night that one of the things that really shocked me and made me take charge of my life was when I realized that I might live like my aunt in Iceland to 108. And I kept thinking, what will I do from 50 to 108? But the beauty that came out of that realization that our expanded life expectancy, according to our statistics, is that you don't have to do everything at once. That there is a time and a season for everything under heaven, and that there is a time to be investing in small children, and there is a time not to be investing in children. There is a time to be investing in a professional life, and there's a time not to be putting professional life first. There is a time and a season for everything. And to be able to sort of get hold of that rhythm and to know when it is time to change, that's the creative act. And another thing is that it doesn't take any creativity to just go and do your own thing and let everybody around you suffer, because you have to be true to yourself. That doesn't take any creativity. Nor does it take any creativity to live a life according to everybody else's shoulds. You should do this and you should do that, you should do this and you should do that. That doesn't take any creativity. Anybody can do that. The creativity comes when you are true to yourself in context of your responsibilities, in which you say, I respect my own gifts and my own uniqueness, but I plan my life in context of all those around me so that I am both responsible to myself and to others, not either or. And that's where the creativity comes in. It is hard and disciplined work. Shall I stop here for a minute for just the basic concept of balancing and the three selves? Are some of you a little confused by the terminology or what I'm trying to say? I mean, everybody understands. All right, then we'll go ahead because I know how the time goes. All right, what I would like to talk about here then is how do you get into this area of work? Well, I can give you a definition of what I mean by a life work. Certainly, it can include a paid job. It can include work in the community and church, anything that is in your work with others but does not carry a price tag. It means your work in the home and anything that has to do with home as you define it. And then it has to do with things that you do in what we call, for lack of a better word, your leisure activities. Now you're noticing that it is a combination of these things that I use to describe the third of your life. So that when people get tied into where almost all their energies are going into their paid job, and they neglect themselves as a human being and neglect their relationships, then not only are they out of balance within the life work self, but then of course they skew everything else. And yet for men in our culture, it has been an incredible pressure to be successful. In fact, one of the things that fascinates me is that if you say he is a successful man, we have generally meant, and I'm just going to risk here because some of you I know will not agree with me, but I think our society as a whole means when you say a successful man that he has been successful in his work. You know, he might not have made any contribution to the community. He might have been really not a good father. He might have been really quite a lousy husband. But if he was successful in his work, in his job, he carried the title successful, especially if he made a lot of money. We put men under tremendous pressure there. But even today, even with all the incredible shifting that's going on in the women's movement and the women's life, when you say she is a successful woman, everybody gets really uncomfortable. They say, what do you mean by a successful woman? For one thing, the definition is not clean. We want to know is if she's successful in her work, but does she have good relationships? Does she like herself? Are her children all out of jail? Has she been divorced lately? And unless we get positives on all fronts, we're not going to give her the label successful. And you say, oh, that's terribly hard on the women. I say, no, that the women are right on that one. You know, we aren't a successful person unless we can say that we are invested in the all areas of our life and that there are times and our seasons when we are not feeling successful at all. But am I a success in the sense of trying to live an authentic life? Now that is the issue for both men and women. But this business of work for men, I have at least 70% of my clients, it's getting to be closer to 80 sometimes, of my clients are men. And the pressure our society puts on them to be successful in the narrow sense in this little piece is really scary. And it's going to be even more scary because I discover that as our society becomes more and more technologically oriented, the big salaries are being reserved for people who are technically competent, but who do not necessarily get a lot of satisfaction out of their work. So that I see men who are paying a very high psychic price for their income. They are doing important work, they feel, but they come and they say, I have no sense of accomplishment. I am just a cog in a very large wheel. I am really struggling to have a sense of myself in action. I am separated, alienated from my work, but it's paying me $48,000 and the whole family has designed a lifestyle around my salary. So that if I try to get into work that I love, Mrs. Morris, my whole family is going to have to reassess who we are as an economic team, and I'm not sure I can risk that, because we've all grown to expect this money, and it's coming at the expense of myself. And women, unfortunately, are starting to buy into this notion that the more you're paid, the more worthwhile you are. And I see it happening with women. Women used to know better. They used to know that if the work in itself was worthwhile, that whether the society valued it or whether they got a high pay for it, it didn't matter. But I see it now that they are buying into the male mode, in which they too say, I am more worthwhile if I'm getting paid, and I am more worthwhile if I'm getting paid a lot of money. And they unfortunately are buying into the same thing, which is understandable, because women have seen themselves as being lesser, and they want to be part of the dominant group, and therefore they are aping, mimicking, if you will, the dominant values. But again, I feel that what we have to look at, just in practical terms, not necessarily from an ideological base, but just simply because we're going to have to, there's not going to be enough paid jobs full-time for everybody. And I rejoice. Why? Because this business of working 8 hours a day for 50 hours a week is not good for people. It's a very new thing. You know, up until the Second World War, we were a rural people. 70% of our population was rural. And as long as we were rural, a man and a woman together formed a team called the family. And the family together earned the income that provided the base. It took both of them and the kids to make an economic unit. And it was only when the Industrial Revolution came in, and for a short period of time, really the twinkling of a historical eye, that for a while the work of one man's hands, multiplied by machines, allowed the man to be productive enough to earn the kind of income that could support a whole family. It's a very recent thing, not more than 100 years old. And so what is happening now is that we're really going back to the old way, in which we're saying, how can we work together as a team so that nobody is putting in incredible hours, nobody is being pushed to the wall to get ulcers and heart attacks, and yet be true to who we are as men and women and get the kind of satisfaction we need from our work. So what I'm discovering here is that men and women of today are trying to carve a whole new way of working. They are trying to let each one of them, both men and women, find a sense of life work. You say, well, what do you mean by this life work? Well, it means not just a job, not just a position, but it means that you're involved, either in your paid or unpaid life, in something that you consider significant. In other words, somewhere, somehow, you are doing work that you see as important. Now, other people might not see it as important. That's neither here nor there. Do you see it as important? Does it give you a feeling that you are tied into the essentials of life? So, do you see a kind of work in which you not only know that it is important, but it is meeting a need? In fact, many times people say, Mrs. Morris, if I could only talk to you for 15 minutes, what would you say to me about a life work? I'd say, I can say it in 3 minutes. Ask yourself this one question. What needs to be done? What needs to be done? Ask yourself that question morning, noon, and night until you have some answers. And pay attention to your gut level response. So that when you're reading a newspaper and you find yourself habitually saying, why doesn't somebody do something about that? Or you watch a TV show and you feel your adrenaline coming up and you think, oh, that is something that must get some attention. Or you're listening to somebody and you say, dear God, isn't anybody doing anything about that? And then you say, maybe I'm supposed to be doing something about that. Because if over a period of time you habitually find yourself responding to a particular need, somebody needs to be doing something about this, maybe that somebody is you. And it's true in a business sense. You know, anybody says to me, I'd love to start a business of my own, I say, fine, ask this one question: what needs to be done? And as soon as you can answer what needs to be done and you can figure out how to make a business around it, you have yourself a very good opportunity in the business world. So that critical question is, what needs to be done? Then you say, all right, if I can determine that it needs to be done, what's the next step? Then you have to say, given who I am, how could I tackle this thing that needs to be done? Because sometimes you can do it with your marketable skills, and you can actually respond to this need through paid work. For instance, when I identified as something that needed to be done, I identified for myself the fact that I felt that people needed to be given a little bit of help to find out how to best use their God-given talents. That some of our best people got hung up on not knowing how to best use their gifts. Once I had determined that, then I had to say to myself, but you're going to have 4 kids in school at once, Alina, so you're going to have to make money out of this idea. You're going to have to make an income. So then I had to say, all right, if that's your conviction, now how are you going to turn it into money? Well, I had to say, all right, I'm going to have to do it in a business-like way. I'm going to have to start a business, but I'm going to be true to my dream. I have to tell you that if I hadn't had to earn money, it still would have been my dream, it still would have been my conviction, but I could have done it with more freedom. As it is now, it has been a highly disciplined, highly demanding kind of work because it has had to be a business based on a social service, which is not easy to pull off, because we don't turn anybody away from the center. I couldn't do that and like myself as a Christian, but I still have to make it pay. And everybody has to go home with their paycheck. So that it is one of those things where I had to say, can you do it and get paid for it? And get paid well for it so that everybody survives as a business. But it doesn't have to be that way, but you have to be true to yourself. You say, all right, this needs to be done. What little piece of it could I do? And if I need to look at my own realities, you say, what age am I? What is my education? What are my skills? Where do I live? Where do I want to live? All those kind of personal realities have to be tied in so that you are very pragmatic and practical about it. I'm not talking about going off on sort of a dream trip where you say, wouldn't it be marvelous if I could do this and so? I would immediately say, how? How? How are you going to do it? Now, given your gifts, given who you are, how do you plan to tackle that? And so then sometimes you say, I'm going to have to design a different kind of life in which I'm going to use my marketable skills in a way that allows me to bring in enough money so that I can pay the bills. And maybe I'm willing to cut back my standard of living so I don't have to have quite so much so I can do my paid work in less hours. But what I'm going to look at then is to say, all right, maybe I'm going to have a paid job, and then I'm going to have the work that I see as my life work over here. And between the two, I'm going to have the satisfactions and feeling of accomplishment that comes from a well-balanced life in the work area. And I see this, of course, and it's always been the pattern among the creative people in our society. You know, in Seattle, we've just got all kinds of drama students and musicians and artists who are waiters, right? I mean, they put in 4 or 6 hours waiting table, and then they do all these things that our society doesn't honor enough to allow them to make a living. But I think that's what's happening now in social services, too. That the jobs in social services are becoming so skimpy, and they've always been so poorly paid, that more and more, if you're going to serve people in our society, I mean, this breaks my heart to say this out loud, but you know it and I know it, so we don't have to pretend. And that is that if it has to do with machines, you'll get a big income. If it has to do with people, you'll be lucky to find a paid job at all. It really is that way. And so again and again, when people come to me with a great desire to serve people's needs, I have to say to them, are you prepared to design something like this? In which you work as much as you need to bring in the money, and then you save and you design a life work without any pay. But you say to yourself, this is really where my heart is. And you go at it with the same discipline. You expect the same kind of professionalism from yourself as if it were a paid work. You are willing to keep yourself educated in the field. You're willing to be disciplined. You're there. You give it the same kind of time as if you were paid. You look to make just as much impact. In fact, when you aren't being paid by anybody, then you can have more impact because you can say whatever you please. I watch that when I start getting paid from certain companies, I have to watch what I say. You know, you can't slap the hand that feeds you, right? And sometimes that's the hand that needs to be slapped. But I watch my tongue when I'm dealing with my clients. Why? Because I've got kids in school. That's why. And you all know what I'm talking about. But if you're not being paid, you can say what needs to be said, and it's a great freedom. So I'm discovering that more and more people are looking at this, and young couples particularly, I'm finding, are saying, here's two of us both with professional skills, and I say, fine. I'm thrilled because then each of you can put in 4 hours. And then you have to find a real life work that both of you can work on together. And you're going to have a team here working on something that you really feel a deep heart commitment to, even if you have to make some money, both of you on the side, and something that you might not be terribly interested in doing, but it provides the bread on the table. Now, another schematic that often happens in the life work pattern is that people come in and they say, you know, Mrs. Morris, I'm not happy in my work. I really don't like it at all. And we do a life study. We do a really careful study of this person. And here is the profile of the individual. And over here, we do a study of the job description, and it's over here, and they're absolutely right, there's no match. And of course, what they would like us to help them do is to find a job that fits right in with who they are. I mean, they would love that kind of a scheme, and I would love to find it for them, you know, to help them really get that sense that who they are and what they do is one and the same. I mean, and there are some who are blessed, truly blessed, in the fact that they feel their work and who they are has no demarcation. And I celebrate when that happens. But I warn them right up front. I say, you know, if I can help you design something like this, I'm going to feel that we did a respectable job for you. If I can help you find paid work in which a significant overlap occurs between who you are as an individual and what you do on the job, that will be, for me, a very satisfactory kind of conclusion to the process. And they say, well, are you telling me that there's going to have to be parts of the working me that just don't get satisfied? What I hear you telling me, Mrs. Morris, I'm going to just have to be satisfied with what I can get. And I'll say, if there's a significant overlap, then I want you to say to yourself, what does this job provide me in the way of psychological satisfaction? This paid work of mine gives me a sense of belonging. I get up in the morning and I have a place to go. There are people expecting me. I'm part of a team. I get a sense of recognition there. People tell me I'm doing a good job. My performance appraisals are good. I feel pretty good about what I'm doing there. I know I do it competently. I get a paycheck, not to be sneered at. I'm glad for it. I'm grateful to have a paycheck. I really have great colleagues. You know, I come in and I've got some friends there. And that's a great kind of pay for me. The only problem is, Mrs. Morris, that the work itself, you know, is not all that satisfying. I don't get a sense of profound contribution. Or I don't get a real sense that I'm learning new things every day. I'm really quite repetitive, you know. It's not bad, but it's sort of boring. I've got more intelligence that I'm not using here. I feel as though I'm sort of working at half-mast. And I'll say, well, okay, but you've got a lot of good things going for you, my friend. Now let's say, what are the things you're not getting? And then we'll say, okay, then we're going to aim at some work in the community that needs to be done, but which you carefully choose to provide you with the things that you don't get in your paid job. So that between the two of them, you'll get the psychological satisfactions you need. Now, I think back on how I did this when I was at home with the small children, because I stayed at home for 12 years. And I think about how I did it, and I was absolutely out of line. I tried to be what other people thought mothers of small children did. So people would call me up and they'd say, would you please help with this, and would you help with that? And being a basically good woman, I tried to respond to whatever it was that people wanted me to do. It was disaster. I experienced a tremendous amount of depression during those years. And I look back on it, and it was simply because I didn't take charge. People would call me and they'd say, Elena, would you mind taking the high school Bible class? We can't get anybody to take the high school Bible class. And I'd say, well, if you can't get anybody, I'll help you. And somebody would say, well, Elena, we need somebody over in the school, you know, to be a room mother. And would you mind being a room mother? And I'd say, well, if you can't get anybody to be the room mother, I'll be the room mother, right? Well, you know, I was the world's worst room mother because they wanted you to bake cookies, and I don't have a 12-minute mind. And I cannot, you know, my cookies were always burned. And so every time I tried to be a room mother, three things happened. The kids would have burnt cookies, my kids would be embarrassed, and my husband would come home to an angry wife. Nobody won. Nobody won. Why didn't I have the guts to say, no, I won't be a room mother, but you need somebody to come and teach music every Wednesday? I'm a very good music teacher. Because if I had done that, my kids wouldn't have had to pretend I wasn't there. I'd give credit to the family name. The teachers would have been blessed by having a teacher who would take their music for them. The kids would get some excellent music teaching, and my husband would have a happy wife. But I never once thought that I should decide where to work in the community. I was in a responsive stage. Who needs help? I will help. In fact, I can remember that time I took the high school Bible class. You know, nobody won that one. I was studying late at Saturday night, you know, trying to think up fascinating things to teach these kids. And I should have said, no, I won't take a high school Bible class, but I sure will get a high school choir going. I'd love to take a high school choir, and maybe I'll get some kids over from the Presbyterian church, and I just might put together a 200-voice teenage choir. Instead, I, for a whole year, sweated through teaching Bible classes, and I'm not a Bible teacher. But I felt I was doing my bit. So that when you've got somebody in the parish, for instance, who's an accountant, do you know what they ask them to do in the parish? They ask them to keep the books. Isn't that brilliant? When in fact what that man needs to do, he's getting all the satisfactions that are available out of numbers from his job, for pity's sake. You should ask him to sing in the choir and get his right brain going. I mean, don't ask people to use their work skills in their volunteer skills. Try to get a balance between what you're doing for pay and what you're doing strictly for love, so that you are getting together the satisfactions that provide about a third of your life energies. Now, this is just plain common sense. You know, I'm not telling you anything you don't sort of know at that level. But we just haven't been taught to think about work this way. And we have thought that if you're not being paid for it, you can do it rather casually. You can do it if you have time, if it's convenient, if it's this or if it's that. While in fact, it doesn't make any difference at all whether you're being paid for it. If it is your heart work, if it is your life work, you do it with excellence. Because it's only when you do it with excellence and with a significant block of time that you get the rewards. So now I only pick one thing. I mean, I'm employed full-time, and I'm running a household. And I cannot do this and this and this and this and do little dabs here and little dabs there. I do one thing well. So I commit myself to one thing in the community, and I give it substantial time, substantial money, substantial disciplined effort. And when I finish doing it and know I have finished, I get out and do something else. But I don't do anything in a half-baked way, because when I did, I became resentful. I wasn't getting any payback. All I was doing was working and to try and help out, and because I wasn't getting a sense of life work, I didn't feel good about it at all. I sort of felt like a martyr, frankly. And who likes a martyr? Nobody that I know. I got obnoxious, if you must know. Simply feeling as though I was being drained, I was being asked to do this, asked to do that, asked to do this, asked to do that. And I felt like I wasn't getting any thanks. And do you know why? Because I wasn't doing anything very well. And I was spread thin. I lost my sense of self-confidence. Where does self-confidence come? It comes from competence. Knowing that you can do something well. And knowing that you are using yourself in your work. And when I was trying to meet other people's shoulds, instead of respecting my own gifts, I didn't get that feeling of self-confidence. And instead, I was feeling as though I was not very good at anything. And it was true, I wasn't very good at anything. And many women ask me, why is it that women get into the middle of their lives with such a low self-image and a sense of low self-confidence? And I said, there's multiple reasons. But one of the major reasons is because historically, women have been sort of the doers of this and that, many different things. And we don't get this sense of disciplined accomplishment. And that's what women get hungry for. In fact, I'll just toss out one thing here to give you an idea of what I think happens between men and women as they go through the life stages on this subject to work. In the 20s and 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, and 80s for that matter, in the early decades, I find that men, even as Freud made the point, that men are very work-oriented. They get an awful lot of their sense of identity out of what it is they choose to do with themselves. That men's identity comes strongly from their work. Relationships are very important to men, of course, but they do not rise and fall on their relationships in the same way that women do. In the 20s and 30s, in the female, I find that their sense of identity comes from a whole bunch of sources. Women are very diffuse in their 20s and 30s, and they just really confuse men badly, because men tend to be psychologically more tidy up there. But where do women get their sense of self in their 20s and 30s? Well, because we are the child bearers. Freud said biology is destiny, and Freud was partly right. We do get a much stronger sense of identity out of our relationships. And not just our primary love relationships. I never know what to call them these days. I'll call them the primary love relationship for lack of a better term. Whoever it is that is really our emotional partner, there's no question but that is really terribly important to women in their 20s and 30s, because we know that part of our life must be satisfied in the 20s and 30s, because biologically the options start to close down here in a way that they don't close down for men. We are also much more tied to our parents. Women still, much more than men, get their sense of identity from who they are in terms of being a daughter of somebody. You know the old saying, a son is a son till he takes him a wife, but a daughter is a daughter the rest of her life. Those old folk tales and folk stories are not out of nowhere. It is true that I find women not really getting a sense of strong, separate identity until more in their late 30s and early 40s, while men most often make a real break of independence in their 20s or early 30s. So that I see not only their primary love relationship, but also their parents, also children define them. Women, even today, even though they are trying very much to keep a separate identity, they still are bodily invested in children. I mean, by the time you've had a baby, you've had to let your blood be diverted, you've had to let your bones be moved, you've had to let your muscles be stretched. I mean, you are invested. And that is an investment that cannot be taken lightly. It is not a head trip. It is the whole self invested. And then I find women are very much more diverse in the sense of where they get their work identity, because women still do what I call the relationship work. Even today, women are still the ones that plan the parties. Women are still the ones that remember that it's Aunt Jane's wedding anniversary. And it's still the women who remember that we should invite so-and-so for dinner because, you know, they had that hard time 2 weeks ago. And so women do a lot of relationship work, even if they're employed. They're the ones that put on the party for the boss that is leaving for a new job. They're the ones that are having a shower for the secretary who is leaving because she's pregnant. They still get a very wide range of satisfactions from their work. What happens in midlife, somewhere in one of those great curves that I illustrated last night, I find men becoming very complicated. And you know what women do? They tend to get focused. Women say, you know, I've been scattered all over the map. I've been doing this, I've been doing that, I've been doing this, I've been doing that. I need a work identity. And the men have been saying, you know, I think I've been investing too much in my work. I think I have missed out on a lot of relationships, and I feel as though I've sort of let my creative self go to pot. And I find the men really wanting to explore other parts of themselves and getting a more interesting mix of identities, just when the women are trying to get centered. And I tell you, this causes some problems, you know, because the women are saying, yeah, you know, I would really like to maybe go back to school. I'd like to sort of get my life back on track. And the man is saying, well, you know what? I think it'd be nice if we took all the kids with us in a motorhome on a trip around the country. And the woman says, you mean all of the kids in a motorhome? I mean, you must be joking. And she says, and besides which, I can't go because I'm going to take the GRE. I'm going to take the graduate record exam next week. I can't take the children around the country in a motorhome. But he says, you know, I'm really anxious to reestablish those relationships. She said, you know, I've had quite a bit of those relationships. And it was a piece of this. And they don't even understand that they're both on a normal track here. You know, because we need both this. You know, the Chinese, I'll have to tell you this next time. This is really what the Chinese call the yang. That we need yin and yang. And the balance, you know, Lao Tzu, the old Chinese philosopher, wrote marvelous pieces on the balancing that comes about through the yin, which is the feminine principle, and the yang, which is the masculine principle. And what I find is that because the women are the child bearers, we are heavily weighted toward the yin side of the mix. We have a yin-dominated mix of traits in our early decades because we are the child bearers. But that men are very much yang dominated in those decades. But then in order to really get our lives fully balanced and integrated, there has to be this process where the men fully, now you have yin and yang at all times, don't misunderstand me, but there is a great surge of integrating the yang, yin and yang, at the midlife. Because there's a marvelous little saying I'll let you go with, because it's 5 to 8 already, and I do want a couple of minutes here for questions. But there's a marvelous little book. Actually, the book isn't so marvelous, but the title is great. It's called Getting Older is Not for Sissies. And it's true. You have to get all the resources you can muster to live well through all the different life stages. And one of the things that helps you to live well is if you get that yin and yang, that masculine and feminine, balanced in your life, so that you're doing some work which is clearly the yin side of you, the intellectual, cognitive, rational, linear kinds of things, and the intuitive, creative, nurturing kinds of work also. So I'm finding that not only is there a balance between the way you work and keeping your work life in balance with your other selves, there is also a need to recognize that you can balance your early life with your later life, that what is appropriate in your early life might be very different than what is appropriate for your later life. You are not locked in to one script. You can make new decisions as you change. Can I help you with some questions? 1 hour time frame means you really have to go. I've sort of given you an awful lot of material here, I know. But it is exciting. It truly is exciting to say, how can I live well in each decade? And I love to tell stories about how people have made life changes, how they've gone through transitions, and have designed whole new kinds of ways of relating and working at each life stage. It's entirely possible. Yes?
Have you discovered any lengthy time that it takes the couple to finally decide what could happen?
No, I have discovered that this transition time is often as much as 3 years. That by the time one way of relating and one way of working is truly ended in a kind of responsible way, so you don't just cut things off and pretend that never was, and finding new ways of working or relating with each other because you've changed and your circumstances have changed, it often takes as long as 3 years. And you know, it fascinates me that the Greeks said that every 7 years, the Chinese insisted every 10 years, and I think they were both right. I think it's 10 years before you get a full new script going, but you probably started to think about it after 7. But then it takes another 3 years to get the next one in full operation.
A lot of marriages dissolve during that period.
Yes. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so critical, because people haven't been taught to respect these changes. All right, my friends, I thank you very much for your attention.